This is an ad by BetterHelp. What's your perfect night? Is it curling up on the couch for a cozy, peaceful night in? Therapy can feel a bit like that, your comfort place where you replenish your energy. With BetterHelp, get matched with a therapist based on your needs, entirely online. It's convenient and suited to your schedule. Find comfort this season with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.com.
Over the last 75 years, over 10,000 chemicals have been introduced to our food supply. Yet the EU only allows 300 food additives. But at Thrive Market, we bring our members the highest quality brands and restrict more than 1,000 ingredients found at conventional grocery stores. Making the switch is easy with our Healthy Swaps scanner, which finds better versions of all your favorite pantry, snacking, and home essentials without the added junk, dyes, and fillers. Plus, it's all delivered straight to your door. So if you're looking to shop at a grocery store that actually cares about your health, go to thrivemarket.com/podcast and you'll get 30% off your first order and a free gift.
Welcome to the Gravity Podcast, where we host conversations on developing a Christian spirituality rooted in love that fosters resilient faith in everyday life.
So let me get this straight. You were hanging upside down playing with your dog. That's why you only got 3 hours of sleep. I have so many questions, Ben, but we got to do this intro. Welcome to the Gravity Commons podcast. This is Matt Tebbe, and I'm joined by Christy and Ben. Hello.
Hey, hey.
Hey. Greetings, everyone.
Good day.
Good day to you.
We've got a lot to talk about today. Number one, we're doing this book club in the Gravity Commons community on Tim Alberta's The Kingdom and the Power and the Glory, and we are on chapter three this week. But it's going great. I would invite anyone and everyone who's listening to join us Fridays, 12 p.m. Eastern, for 1 hour. Paid members of the Gravity Commons. It's $25 a month. You get access to classes, courses, community, and this club, all the C's. It's great. It's a lot of fun. We had like, I don't know, every first Friday is free. So if you want to join us the first Friday of September and you, just to check it out, you can do that too.
Yep. If you're interested and you're not part of this, go to gravitycommons.com/bookclub. gravitycommons.com/bookclub and sign up. There's a form there and it'll get you all the info and connect you. You can always email us if you have any questions about it.
I'm also pulling together a gravity formation course group. Got a few more spaces in that. This is our 12-month training program. You hear, you probably fast forward through the ad a lot when you listen to this podcast. But
one of the ads is for the course.
It's really, really good. I just highly recommend it to learn how to love and live like Jesus. So
that's how I got into gravity, y'all. I did it, and then I was like, I want to do it again. And you were like, we don't do it a second year. I'm like, yes, you do.
Yes, you do. Now you do.
We do now.
Yep. We do now.
Whatever Christy wants, Christy gets. So, yeah. Anyway, just send me an email, matt@gravitycommons.com, and I can maybe set up a time to chat with you about it, see if it's right, see if, you know, if it's a good fit.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a weekly call. Essentially, we take you through like a curriculum that we've developed. And it's a weekly call. The time of the call is determined by, essentially determined by the participants. We usually are able to find a time that works for everybody's calendar. And so that's the way we do it now is just you register your interest and then we figure out a time to meet and make it all work. So,
and it's so good, you guys. I mean, I thanks, love Christy. My cohort time. It's so fun. I love the women in there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Christy's leading one now as well.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, anything else? Anybody got a story or a recommendation or, you know, a folksy?
You know, it's my oldest's birthday today. So I'm focused on like, I need to, he likes lobster and I don't really know how to make lobster.
Oh yeah.
I've and never. You know, he likes tapioca pudding instead of a cake. And I feel, I'm just not a great cook. So I got a little angst, but I'm excited to celebrate him.
Is he 17 today?
No, Alexander.
Oh, Alexander. I'm sorry. I was thinking of Soren.
Yeah. So we're going to celebrate.
He's in his 40s
tonight,
now, right?
40s. Oh, man. We get to celebrate him. It's going to be great.
Wonderful.
Yeah, that's fun. It's my anniversary today.
Oh, happy anniversary. How many years?
24.
Come on.
24.
Next year's a big one.
It is a big one.
They call that
next
silver?
Year, you need to drop off your kids to Colorado and then take Sharon somewhere very fun.
Oh, okay.
That's what I think. Well. Let's plan it right now.
Well.
All right.
Well, okay. You heard it, folks. He just committed. Sharon, I hope she heard it too.
Yeah. I'll send her the recording.
There you go.
I'm locked in. Yeah, that'd be fun. I don't know. We actually have, I don't think we've ever done that.
You need to.
I know. You and Paul do that a lot.
Yeah, we do. And it's, I'm telling you, once you do it, you're like, why don't we do this more often? So good.
That's funny.
All right. Well, today we're chatting with Hillary McBride on practices for embodied living, experiencing the wisdom of your body.
Yeah.
Ben, what do you remember about this interview?
I remember being impressed, as always, with Hillary McBride, with her ability to sort of, just speak very compassionately and very intelligently about things that really matter to all of us. And I think there's... I also remember being impressed with her... ability to connect kind of some of these, practices of the body, some of these things that I think sometimes we think of these kinds of practices as private, individual kind of ways to escape from the world.
Yeah.
But she has a really great way of connecting these embodied practices to our desire for justice, to the ways that our society around us sort of tries to conscript us into its modes of anxiety and fear and service to mammon and all of these things. And I was impressed with the way that she consistently came back to that, to say, like, one of the best ways for you to practice like embodied justice is for you to just sort of take authority back of your own body from all these forces that are outside of us that are trying to, conscript us into service to mammon and all kinds of stuff. So I was impressed with that, with her ability to do that.
Yeah. Well, we should get into this.
Yeah. Why don't you give us a bio for Hillary? Maybe we should hear a little bit about her.
Well, listen up then. Dr. Hillary McBride is a registered psychologist, a researcher, and a podcaster with expertise that includes working with trauma and trauma therapies, embodiment at the intersection of spirituality and mental health. Her first book, Mothers, Daughters, and Body Image, Learning to Love Ourselves as We Are, was published in 2017. She was the senior editor of the textbook Embodiment and Eating Disorders, Theory, Research, Prevention, and Treatment, which was published in 2018. Her best-selling book, which we chatted with her about here, is called The Wisdom of Your Body, Finding Wholeness, Healing, and Connection Through Embodied Living. And that came out in the fall of 2021. And in January, she released the book we're chatting with her about today, Practices for Embodied Living. Her next book, Holy Hurt, Understanding and Healing from Spiritual Trauma, comes out in April 2025. We'll have to have her back for that. Mm-hmm. She has been recognized by the American Psychological Association and the Canadian Psychological Association for her research and clinical work, in addition to being a teaching faculty at Trinity Western University. She is an ambassador for Sanctuary Mental Health and the host of CBC's award-winning podcast, Other People's Problems. Hillary makes her home in the Pacific Northwest in British Columbia, Canada.
In other words, she's a little bit of a baller. So
she
get ready.
Is. She's a rock star.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. We should be quiet. We should be more quiet and listen to her now. Dr. Hillary McBride, welcome to the Gravity Commons podcast.
I'm so happy to be with you. Thanks for having me.
It's a joy and a pleasure. I wonder, in your bio, you mentioned that you also host a podcast. Oh. And I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about what you chat about there.
Yeah. So probably a little unlike other podcasts and maybe unlike what we're used to hearing from therapy and therapists, but the podcast was actually the idea of my producer, Jody Martinson, who's a CBT producer. She's Emmy winning. She's so gifted. And her idea was, how do we demystify mental health and therapy? How come is it that all of our therapeutic insights, our gains, our struggles happen in these private worlds and in such a way kind of isolate us from each other and give us the perception of feeling like we're, you know, we're the only ones who think that way or talk that way or have that struggle? And can there be something gained from bringing people into that inner sanctum, that private world? Mm-hmm. And so the podcast, Other People's Problems, is really me just doing therapy with my patients. And we have microphones in sessions and we just do therapy as normal. And then people consent to it, obviously, right? They have a choice to say that, yes, I want this recorded and I want this shared. And then the episode is crafted by reducing the audio down and me putting a little bit of voiceover in to explain what I'm doing and why. But really what we found from people is that it really undoes the aloneness around so many of the mental health struggles that we have. And I think really shifts the perception that therapy is for the, you know, the people with really acute mental illness, air quotes, like the people who are over there, who are unlike me, and reminds us that therapy gets to be for everybody and can include not just the things that we identify as being really challenging, but can be a way to work on relational skills and feel seen and witnessed even in the beautiful things in our life.
I love that. Hmm. And that reminds me of a podcast you turned me on to by Esther Perel. Hmm. Hillary, do you know Esther Perel?
Not personally, no.
Ben, what's the name of that podcast where she like, she does
Where Should We Begin?
Where Should We Begin?
Yeah. She kind of records a therapy session and then intersperses it with her comments sort of as she reflects on the session herself. Yeah. And sometimes it's really interesting because sometimes she'll be like, I wish I would have done this here, or I missed this, you know, that kind of thing is very fascinating.
Mm-hmm. It's wild to think about what's in the collective unconscious. Our podcast came out at the same time. And without us knowing about what the other was going within a few months of each other. And obviously we, you know, I'm sure it was the case for her too. We'd been working on ours for about 3 years, trying to get ethical checks done and kind of legal things and journalistic standards of practice. And so to have them come out at the same time is like, wow, there's like something shifting in the mental health world and how we're really trying to demystify this. It's necessary, obviously.
Hmm. Yeah.
I love that.
Well, in many ways, Hillary, the book that we're discussing today, your latest book, Practices for Embodied Living, Experiencing the Wisdom of Your Body. As I read this book and sort of participated with the book, I did feel like I was sitting somewhat with you. There's an accompanying that this book communicates and invites me into. And I wonder if you could just talk about maybe the medium of writing a book and how oftentimes there's a distance between what you're reading and the person who's writing it, or it's not the same as being in a room or even being here on a video chat talking about the book. Mm. But was it intentional as you wrote this that the reader would feel accompanied by you? Mm. And if so, how did you set about to do that?
Thank you for asking that. And it feels so moving to know that that's how you experienced it, because that's exactly what I would want. And I think there's something about the format of it, which is that it's meant to be experiential. The prompts, the questions, the things that I write are meant to provoke a reaction or an experiment or an experience. And I think that we don't often write in that way. We don't often read in that way. We kind of see this, you know, writing as this transcribed soliloquy. And this is meant to be a series of doorways that you open or keys that I hand you. And so there's something very interactive about that you get to decide, what do I want to answer this question? Do I want to do it now? Oh, someone's asking me. Like, I'm speaking directly to you as I write. I'm writing directly to you. I want for you to try this. I want for you to know this. Mm. So I think that is meant to take this book from being just this really cerebral cognitive endeavor into mm-hmm. something that feels embodied and relational, which is really the whole point of the material.
Yeah.
I want people to have a felt sense of something. They want it to feel like it happens in a relational context.
Yeah. And I had some maybe trepidation mm-hmm. about that, and in the sense of one of sort of my life goals these last few years is to take my body more seriously as a place of knowledge and intimacy and memory and all that. And I was like, am I going to be able to get in touch with that? Because I have a little bit of anxiety about that, or fear about that, I think. There's a statement at the beginning of your book that arrested me in a way. Mm. And it was the statement, there is more wisdom in the hands holding this book than in the pages of the book the hands are holding. And my body reacted intensely to that. Mm. I wanted to protest it, Hillary. Mm. Like, you're the expert here, right? Mm. Like, that's why I got your book. But I wonder if you could... But as I read, I feel like that I was opened up to the truth in that statement. I wonder if you could talk a bit about what you mean by that statement and why it's important to reckon with that if we're going to get in touch or be more present and embodied.
Yeah. I think that we exist in cultures that are constantly reminding us that there's somebody who knows more than us. And we get really used to that hierarchy. Someone's the guru, someone's the pastor, someone's the teacher. And there's often a story that goes along with that, I think, in faith-based contexts or religious contexts, wherein you can't know, you can't trust yourself because what's inside is really dangerous and bad. Yeah. And so therefore, what gets outsourced is a kind of spiritual authority that somebody else gets to know more and that somebody else does know more. And it's because actually you're untrustworthy that they know more, and therefore you need to defer to them and their insight and their wisdom. And I think that that's part of what's created these schisms in the first place within us that we carry around, is that we, for whatever reason, whether it's been because of our trauma or a cultural story or gender or a religious context, many of us live with the legacy of being told that what's inside of us is bad and can't be trusted. And so therefore we have a like a pattern or a predisposition in a way to look elsewhere mm-hmm. as if elsewhere knows everything and has all of the insight.
Yeah.
And we forget that, well, one, I think that system has really been co-opted in a way to keep power in the hands of certain people. Like, if we mistrust ourselves and we don't look inside, then other people will have us continuing to defer to them as the sources of insight or guidance or spiritual authority. And it works for them, right? People benefit from that. And I think when we look at what's inside, that it requires us to actually interrupt those systems. Like, I'm thinking about systems of patriarchy and hierarchies of dominance and authoritarianism, and thinking about even looking at the way that we colonize the land and our patterns of existing so much in the idea of somebody else being superior. There's kind of like a dissolving of the hierarchy that happens when we say, whoa, what's inside? And what do I know? And what do I start to do about that? That moves us both into awareness of the goodness inside, but also moves us into a sense of responsibility taking. Like, oh, actually, there's a whole bunch of information happening here that I need to get to know and understand how to be in relationship with. And simply me saying like, oh, you're reading this book because you want to reenact that pattern of someone else knowing more than you? Like, no, I'm just going to start from the front and say, we're not doing that here. I'm just going to hand it back to you and say, like, every chapter is like, what's happening inside of you? Try this. Yeah. What do you think? Come back. You get to have autonomy. You get to have agency. You get to have choice. And I'm not going to rescue you from the distress you feel inside about that. And I'm not going to tell you that, you know, I have all the information or the answers about how it is to be you in your body in the world. And it's meant to be in some ways, a wink or a nod to any other kinds of ways of being that invert these systems that keep us disconnected from ourselves and from each other.
We'll be right back. The Gravity Podcast is sponsored by the Gravity Formation Course, a 12-month cohort-based training in practical spiritual formation, where you'll learn to notice how God is already at work in your life so you can participate more fully in the life God shares with us. It's a discipleship process that goes beyond just gaining more knowledge and trying new practices. In the Gravity Formation Course, we go below the surface of our lives so that we can notice and name our deepest desires in God's presence, and to discern how God is at work in those desires to lead us towards holistic flourishing, more transformation, more life, more joy, more love. We've trained hundreds of people all over the world in this formation framework, and it has helped many people to have a sense of God at work in their lives, to learn how to be more at home in God's love. If you'd like to learn more, go to gravitycommons.com/formation.
Let's get back to the show.
I wonder if you could talk a little bit about how we get disconnected from ourselves and from each other, because it's kind of a funny, I mean, if you think about it, it's a funny thing to say that we could be like disconnected from our bodies, because there's so like, yeah. It's hard to even imagine what a human being would be without a body, right? So it's like, how do we get disconnected from this, you know, these flesh and bones that are so integral to who we are? I'm thinking about this, I guess, because that was sort of I've learned this, you know, recently, but like my strategy growing up was to sort of just ignore these emotions that were happening in my body and, you know, sort of, become unaware of them because they were uncomfortable. I didn't know what to do with them. And I actually work with, you know, in spiritual direction and coaching and just pastoral counseling, I work with quite a few people who would say the same thing. They're just like, I don't know what I'm feeling. And so I don't know, what are some of the things that cause this? Like, you know, people saying that, you know, I feel disembodied, or I feel like I could crawl out of my skin, or, you know, what are some sources of that experience that contribute to this sense of estrangement and distance from our own bodies?
Mm-hmm. I'm so glad that you set that question up the way you did too, just before I answer the question, because I think you're actually getting to the heart of this, which is that we're never actually disconnected from our body. We just learn to funnel the awareness of what's happening in our body so far away from our consciousness, like so far away from where we spend time and how we identify, that we perceive our bodies as not being there or not giving us information.
Interesting.
And we can say that that's both a narrative thing that happens and kind of a value thing, but that at times can be a psychobiological thing as well, when what's happening in the body is so overwhelming that this, you know, mechanism starts getting enacted. We call it dissociation. It's often mediated by this change in how neural projection happens based on integration between different lobes in your brain. And there's like an endogenous opiate mediated component, which is similar to about 8 milligrams of morphine. Like when something is overwhelming, your system kind of self-administers about 8 milligrams of morphine, which creates this, again, endogenous opiate release and dissociated phenomena. So it's actually like not feeling anything. Right. So you could have like, I don't care to notice. I'm disavowing from it. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to pay attention. My energy is elsewhere, or actually kind of like bottom up, just not sensing anything. But it's all there, right? Body's still there, right? You're still walking around. You're still feeding yourself. You're still sleeping. You're still probably going to notice if you stub your toe, maybe.
Right.
So it's like, yeah, what are we? Yeah. Maybe. Yeah. But we can look in the research literature to see kind of three categories of things that result in this disconnection. And they would be the social, the cognitive, and the physical. Mm. And you could further break those down and say, okay, the physical, like, we might have experiences that feel pretty overwhelming for our bodies, like trauma would fit into that category. Maybe there's something about the sensations in our body. Like sometimes people who have chronic illness, chronic pain, even things like allergies, autoimmune stuff, right? Your body might just be overwhelmed with sensation that's hard to be with. And so it becomes easier to go, I'm just not going to go there. I'm just not going to feel that. I'm not going to spend time there. We have the cognitive pieces, like the stories that we tell, and often those are introjects. Those are things that get inserted into our stories based on the context we're in. So if you think about a religious context, people actually saying, your body is bad. Mm-hmm. People with authority who you've been learned to, again, defer to as having authority over you are saying, don't trust your body. Your body's bad. It's going to keep you away from God. Well, right, all of a sudden, we have a pretty compelling inner narrative that says, don't listen, don't listen, don't listen. Right? Yeah. That's bad, that's bad, that's bad. And then we have the social piece, which really looks at the distribution of power. And perhaps there's a sense of, you know, if I'm connected to my body, then I'm on the outside of this group. Like a really good example of this would be kind of how embodied presentation across racial lines emerges. Like if you think about how often, let's say, Black women have to deal with the trope of the angry Black woman narrative. And so if a Black woman is connecting to or needs to be connected to people who are white and hold white supremacist ideals, and connecting to her anger is going to threaten her safety, then maybe the sense of like, I'm going to shove this down is a way to stay safe, but it means disconnecting from the body. Or if we look at queer folks who are often thinking about code switching in social contexts, kind of like, I'm going to suppress the expression of my queerness because it actually makes my body be unsafe in social spaces where violence would be enacted on me. So I'm going to kind of disconnect from that. I'm going to learn to play the role of the straight person or the cis person or whatever. I'm going to move that awareness, the impulse to do anything else, I'm going to move it away, and that allows me to stay safe in this power hierarchy.
Yeah.
Gosh, I want to ask about 3 dozen questions about all that, Hillary.
There's so much here, right?
It's really,
I think one of the comment I'll make, I guess, about what you've said, Hillary, is that I think one of the big paradigm shifts for me that was so helpful for me in learning to pay attention to what my body was doing was that, you know, like disconnecting from my body almost always is this survival mechanism, right? It's almost always some sort of narrative, or like you were saying, like a cultural reality. There's something feels threatening. And this is a way for me to feel safe. And it allowed me to have some compassion for myself for sort of doing this, you know what I mean? Like, why did I let this happen? Or how could I, you know, that kind of narrative gets interrupted by, oh, I was just trying to keep myself safe. Like that's pretty universal. You know, we're all trying to stay safe, you know, and survive. And that was just really, I guess, a helpful realization for me that I heard in what you were naming there.
There's so much compassion that can be engendered by understanding this as like the only thing that we knew how to do, the only thing that could have been done at that time.
Yeah.
And I think that the thing that I'll add in there too is where we can start to talk about the intersection between safety and power, and how sometimes what we're also trying to do is stay safe by being like the people who have the most power.
Yes.
And what's interesting is what that cuts us off from, but then at times how we benefit from that, right? We become safe, but also, oh, now I can be this person who's showing this dominance with my body, or this telling this story about the way that I express my gender or whatever in such a way that, what am I doing to somebody else in their body? And how the thing that kept us safe becomes the thing that gets us power, that becomes the thing that hurts someone else. It's like, you can start to pull that string, and there's a lot that can begin to unravel. But I think it can be, if we work backwards from that, we can see perhaps all of the people who have power in a way that they inflicted on other people, we can trace that back to some origin of, I bet that they were just trying to stay safe too. And wow, under all of that facade, I wonder if there's a lot of fear there too. I wonder if there's a lot of disconnection, and it can kind of dismantle the illusion of the power as being impenetrable or like earned.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. That's exactly, I think the thread that I started thinking about as well. That has been another paradigm shift for me is recognizing that even the people that sort of irritate or make me angry at the way they're hurting people and using power, like it's all at the base just fear. They're just so afraid.
Yeah.
They're so afraid.
Yeah.
And that, I think that helps me to, I guess, have some, it helps me to deal more adequately with the situation. If I can recognize that. So.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Hillary, I wonder if we could maybe pivot to talk through the
pedagogy of practices, maybe mm-hmm. how practices educate and transform. Because it's a little different, right? We're talking here and we can see each other. Mm-hmm. And I think seeing each other helps in this conversation because it's nice to see bodies and see facial expressions, et cetera. But there's a way in which just listening to this podcast, if Hillary were to say to the listener, hey, be more at home in your body. Like someone couldn't just make that decision cognitively, right? Mm-hmm. So what can you talk through how practices are, the power of practices and why they're important if we're going to appropriate sort of this homecoming that mm-hmm. you summon us to in this book?
Yeah, I think it requires us to dismantle the idea that learning is a cerebral or cognitive endeavor exclusively, and really demands us to remember that so much of the learning that happens in life is what we would call bottom-up learning, is procedural learning. Like the difference between, this is one of my favorite analogies to think about because it's usually so on the nose. If I said to you, like, does memorizing a recipe about the best pasta in the world tell you what it tastes like?
Right.
No, right? Like there's an experiential learning that happens when you taste it all of a sudden. And there's something novel about that, right? There's something experiential. You're getting so many more senses on board. Mm-hmm. You're getting different regions of the brain on board. But if the learning in particular is meant to be about being in the body, it's so important that we do that in an embodied way, right? In an experiential oriented way, instead of just, I'm going to tell you a story about this and assume that that means that it's going to translate down into your tissues. So I think this is strategic in that we actually know there's about 9 times more information going from body to brain than brain to body. It's pretty compelling, actually, when you look at like the amount of real estate that a person exists in, how much the nervous system attributes to everything neck down is a lot.
Wow.
And we have a story in our culture that's not the case, right? There's so much. I think this is androcentrism at its finest. I think the kind of this perception that like the mind is the way that we learn best or orient to the world. But if any of us think about our lives and think about how much we do during the day, it's because we've had all these moments of experiential learning that have accumulated to even create the sense of self, the ease that I can sit down in the chair, that I pick up a fork and I know how to use the fork. It's not because my mom told me to memorize the 6 steps of picking up a fork when I was a kid. It's because I did it 1,000 times, right? Mm-hmm. And I learned the way to hold the fork best.
Yes.
So when we're actually trying to meet material, embodied or bottom-up learning is a very, very important way of getting things really deeply encoded inside of us. But I would be really missing something if I was writing a book about embodiment and I told people to just do thinking exercises.
Just think about it.
Right? Yeah, right, there's kind of this confluence of like, no, I'm trying to have the parallel process meet of the mechanism of pedagogy meet the actual material in such a way that it lines up experientially and moves really deeply into us.
Yeah, that's good.
Yeah. Well, it's impossible to go through each chapter. There's chapters on sex and gender. There's a chapter on politics. You know, you've already mentioned the way that our bodies are scripted culturally by gender and sex and race and size and beauty, et cetera. But over and over again, and you even have a chapter on this, but it comes up in other chapters too, you focus on maybe, you bring to the foreground the primacy of dealing with our feelings and emotions and desires as integral pieces of how our body works and how we experience our body. You know, we've already referenced the practice part of this book is like the power of it. I wonder if you could give our listeners a flavor or an example of what a practice would be or an exercise would be to help us relate better or more faithfully or helpfully to our feelings and emotions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, I won't hide this fact that as a psychologist, understanding feelings and relating to feelings is a really important way of how I understand how people are motivated, how they think, how they make decisions, kind of what creates distress in our bodies, what creates aliveness. You can even think about feelings as ways that we know, ways that we come to know ourselves and know the world and care for each other. So they're central to mediating processes around mental health. I can't understate how important this, or it couldn't be possible to overstate how important it is to talk about emotions. And so when I'm supporting people to get connected to feelings, sometimes when we don't even know what the feelings are and where they exist inside of us, it can be helpful to have a little like exposure game, so to speak, like a little way to kind of like, whoa, provoke emotions, which allows us to go, oh, whoa, that's how they move inside of us. Because each emotion has a physiological signature. Each emotion is doing a different thing and shows up in our body in a very particular way based on biophysiology, based on social communication. Like each emotion, and this is not my language, but it has an adaptive action tendency. Yak Pongsep has said that emotions are ancestral tools for living. So if they're tools, right, with any other tool, right, you pick up a pen, it's like, what's this tool do? Well, it tells me something about what it does. If there's a point to it and it moves in a direction and something comes out the top, it's like, oh, that tells us about what it's trying to do. So let's take, for example, disgust, right? We've got a few core emotions in our body. And maybe as like a little practice around emotion, I might say, like, if you were to come to my house and you were to see in my fridge, like a really moldy old, like leftovers. And I was to say, hey, can you run and grab the, you know, those leftovers from the fridge, just pop open the top and like heat it up for us. And you were to open my fridge and you were to see that. Can you just show me for a moment kind of what would happen in your body if you opened that up and you smelled it and saw it? Yeah. Right. Exactly. Okay. Matt.
Listener, we're making disgust faces.
Yeah. Yes, exactly. But what I described, I saw a grimace. I saw you recoil. Yeah. I saw a retraction in your neck. I saw this like, right. There's a closing of your orifices, quite literally, like nose shape changes, eyes change, mouth, right. We do things like that. So, you know, we could play the same game where if I put up a picture between us of, you know, a kid or someone you love, right? Someone in your family who like the person, maybe even one of the people you love most in the world. And I was to show you that photo, right? Think about what your body would do then, right? There would be, I see a little smile, right? Sometimes what happens is like we soften, we lean in a little bit, right? There's a feeling of warmth in our chest. So we can engage in practices like this where we're kind of playing with what the emotions do to help us get acquainted with them, just in a like a get to know you sense. Like, yeah. What does that feeling do? Disgust. Like, oh, it pulls my neck back. It does this thing with my mouth. It kind of like there's inside things that happen with the emotion and there are outside things that happen with the emotion. And the more we start to get to notice those things and get to like practice with them and play with them, put a word on them, it starts to make it easier to notice them in situations where we're not just practicing and playing around. I might feel this like, oh, like this neck jolt back and my face grimace and eyes, ooh, right? And what I'm noticing is someone made a racist comment or someone made a sexist comment or someone did something really violent to another person. And I go, oh, whoa, that's my body saying, I feel disgusted by the way that person treated that other person. Whoa, that tells me something about what this feels like for me and what I value.
Yeah.
And now a word from a sponsor.
Over the last 75 years, over 10,000 chemicals have been introduced to our food supply. Yet the EU only allows 300 food additives. But at Thrive Market, we bring our members the highest quality brands and restrict more than 1,000 ingredients found at conventional grocery stores. Making the switch is easy with our Healthy Swaps scanner, which finds better versions of all your favorite pantry, snacking, and home essentials without the added junk, dyes, and fillers. Plus, it's all delivered straight to your door. So if you're looking to shop at a grocery store that actually cares about your health, go to thrivemarket.com/podcast and you'll get 30% off your first order and a free gift.
Experience holiday cheer at Tanger Outlets with savings up to 70% off your favorite brands. From fragrances to accessories and the latest styles, discover the best gifts for everyone on your list.
Save big at Nike Factory Store. Michael Kors, Under Armour, Coach, Polo Ralph Lauren, Kate Spade New York, and so many more. Unwrap the best at Tanger Outlets. Hundreds of brands, endless gifting options. Plan your trip at tanger.com.
All right, let's get back into our conversation.
What I hear you saying is like sort of that bottom-up learning, Hillary, that you mentioned before. Most of us had to learn how to be disassociated or distanced from our bodies. And we did that through practicing a lack of awareness or tuning out. And so the way back into being at home in our body is to just practice tuning in. One of the things that you're saying.
Yeah. And I think maybe the implicit thing in what I'm saying too is, you notice how I was tracking your bodies and communicating to you what I saw and reflecting that back to you, right? Like, oh, Ben, I saw like a little movement of your lip on the left half, you know, the left side. And I saw this thing with your neck. We're not only just practicing not noticing, but I think the other side of it is that emotions and awareness of emotions is a socially dependent phenomena in our early stages of development. We actually require people to notice and track and then give us names for those things to help us be able to integrate all of that together in our awareness and believe that it's valuable enough to notice. And for many of us, we were told, don't listen, don't pay attention, it's bad, go away, don't feel that. And so we also missed the opportunity to have someone say, oh, I just noticed something shifted inside. I saw your body move backwards and your head turned down when that kid made that other comment. Yeah. I'm wondering if there's something about what they said that hurt. Yeah. I'm wondering if this feels like ouch inside. There's a word for that. But we call that sadness. And to have someone notice and give us names for things creates salience, right? Yeah. It tells us like, well, this is meaningful. This is important. And it also helps us remember, oh, that did happen. My mouth did move that way. My head did move that way. And we can start to become aware of those things because we know even what to look for.
Yeah. Yeah. I noticed, Hillary, that part of my journey of getting more in touch with my body and doing those things has been also as a parent to help narrate and identify what my kids are experiencing and feeling.
Exactly.
So shame. You're feeling shame right now. This is what shame feels like, and those kinds of things. Mm-hmm. And in my best days, I'm able to do that instead of me just reacting out of my own shame or my own anger, etc. Mm-hmm. There's so much to discuss in this book, Hillary. But maybe to close, at the end of the book, you've got sort of a leader guide on how someone can lead people through chapter by chapter and practices. I wonder if you have any suggestions for people who would like to start a group. I mean, I'm thinking of starting a group like this at our church because we've been talking about the body as a place of meaning and importance and understanding and communication, et cetera. But very little practical tools to kind of hack our way back into our bodies. And I feel like your book provides that. But I wonder if you have any suggestions on people who want to explore this more with others, like what are some things you would recommend?
Yeah. I'm not going to get a comprehensive list, and the list will be in the back of the book. So if you're really interested in that, for those listeners, like, go have a look, because there's recommendations about how to set it up and how to spend your time and how to assess for goodness of fit and managing the environment and talking about the group with others. So all of that stuff is there, but I think it could be as simple as a few people who want to get together and say, like, do you want to learn this too? And that you decide to share who's going to ask the questions and the prompts, and that you decide to hold the space in a non-judgmental way, and that you make sure that people know that you're all coming to learn and learn to be connected to yourselves more. There's no right or wrong way to do that. But it really, like, I've heard book clubs practicing this. There's group therapy groups that people have started for, 8 to 12 weeks, where you're actually processing week by week through each chapter and getting a chance to not only experiment, but then talk about what the experimenting is like. And I think that there can be varying degrees of formality of how you join groups. But I mean, even as simple as saying, like, if you're, let's just say you're in a church or you're in leading a staff meeting or like have a gathering of a group of people for ceremony work, or you're sitting to have some sort of celebration, even just pausing to say, hey, let's take a moment to notice what's happening in our bodies, can be such a great way to integrate tools and prompts like this into larger settings where maybe it's not the focus of the meeting, but you're remembering that as we gather, we're gathering as bodies, and let's center what's happening here to check in, to kind of cleanse the palate, to know what we're working with, to remember that our bodies can be consulted in group spaces, which often is not something that we do unless we're at a dance class or we're at a, right. you know, like yeah. a whatever.
Right. The book, again, is called Practices for Embodied Living, Experiencing the Wisdom of Your Body. Hillary, where can people interact with you or connect with you more if they want to do that?
Yeah. So my website, HillaryLMcBride.com. And then I probably hang out most on Instagram, Hillary Leanna McBride. And every once in a while, I pop off on some other social media forums and threads and whatnot. But that's probably the one that I use the most. And I send out a newsletter maybe twice a year with stuff I have going on and coming up, because I do a lot of experiential stuff, as you can imagine, workshops and retreats and lectures and things like that. So you can find that there. And I've got a new book coming out in April. So have a look for that. It'll be April 2025. It's called Holy Hurt, and it's all about religious and spiritual trauma, which is so deeply connected to this material. So if you're interested in this conversation, you're probably gonna like
have
that.
You back on. Talk about that.
We will. Totally. Hillary, thanks for being with us today.
Such a pleasure. Thank you so much for having me and your thoughtful questions and engaging in my experiments. Feels so good to have done that with you.
Ben, one of the things I was thinking about that we didn't get a chance to talk about is very, very early in the interview, Hillary mentioned the some of us who grew up in religious environments internalize really negative stories or scripts about our body and our desires, that they're bad, that they're sinful,
untrustworthy,
you know, that our passions are, you know, sin is crouching at the door waiting to devour you. Mm-hmm. And I just know in conversations with people in the Gravity Commons community and people in our church, like, this is the thoroughly unhelpful and in some ways damaging work that, like, the messages and stories about sex, sexuality, pleasure, desire that we received in religious spaces, and how, I don't know, it feels like it's like all still kind of clinging in our bodies, you know, like we can't quite shake purity culture, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's right. I think there's a pretty big paradigm shift that happens when you can, and this, you know, this comes, you know, some of the exegetical work, you know, and like historical work that people have done in terms of like some of the Bible passages, for example, that talk about sexuality or, you know, those kinds of things. It seems that most of them, like the badness of whatever is being described there, even though a lot of them are pretty vague in terms of like, we don't really know exactly what Paul's talking about in some of these passages, but it does seem like a lot of what's being described has to do with domination. It has to do with like power,
exploitation.
Yeah. It has to, like, the wrongness of it is not the pleasure of it. The wrongness of it has to do with the power that's being exploited, you know, and the exploitation of the weak and, you know, that kind of a thing. And so that feels like a really big paradigm shift that,
yeah,
maybe can give us permission to say, well, maybe we could rethink, you know, we could rethink how we think about sexuality. Because, I mean, obviously I think that's what's sort of lurking behind a lot of our fears of our bodies, you know, or exploring what's going on in our bodies, because, you know, that's very much, you know, part of what our bodies do, you know, and part of what they, you know, how we relate to each other. And so there's a sexuality aspect of it that is, you're right, there's a lot of taboos around it that I think need to be deconstructed.
So. Yeah, and you just named one of them, the fact that, like, the scriptures are more concerned about misusing power and using sex to misuse power than they are policing your genitals.
Yeah.
And I think that's a fairly controversial and maybe, like, new statement for people to hear.
It could be, yeah.
You know, I feel like we need to do like a series on that. Want to do a series on that?
Sure.
Just talk to people about sex for like, I don't know, 18 weeks.
Sure. As many people as we can get talk about it, I guess. So, I mean, yeah. I mean, it is something I think that, we have a lot to learn about. And I think we come out of this world, I think a lot of our listeners do, out of the world where, you know, the sort of the purity culture was the assumed good. The assumed like, oh, that's biblical. That's very clearly the best, you know, that kind of thing. And so coming out of that, there's a lot of confusion and a lot of things that need to be rethought and worked through. So.
Yeah. Well, that was wonderful.
It was great. It's always, we've had Hillary on before, haven't we, a few years ago? I think we talked about
the wisdom of your body.
But she's fantastic. Just so much knowledge, so much gentleness and wisdom and compassion as well. I just find her approach, even just being on a podcast, felt like this healing presence almost. Just be this is great. You know, hear you teach a little bit, hear you talk about this stuff, you know, run a little experiment. By looking at our faces and describing what was happening. That was all very fun. It was great.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Do you know why Scandinavian warships have barcodes on the hull?
Scandinavian warships have barcodes on the hull. No.
So they can Scandinavian.
Scandinavian. Yep. That makes sense. That makes sense.
Scandinavian.
I got it. Scandinavian.
Did you get it?
Yeah,
I couldn't tell because you weren't laughing.
I have a, I don't know. I feel morally obligated not to laugh. So need to teach you a lesson.
You're like the people closest to you have written me and told me
don't
the
you
best
dare.
Thing you can do for Matt.
Don't give if him you, anything.
If you really
give
him love nothing. Him. Yeah. Right. Well, anyway. Until next time, listener. Adios.
Thanks for joining us for this episode of the Gravity Podcast. If you're finding it helpful, please tell your friends about it. Word of mouth is the best advertising. Ratings and reviews online also help others find the podcast. And don't forget to subscribe so you don't miss an episode. To join discussions about the podcast and lots more, join us in the Gravity Commons. It's free to join, and you can connect with other listeners to the podcast to talk about faith, spirituality, and whatever else comes up. To join, go to gravitycommons.com/community. The Gravity Podcast is produced by Ben Sturkey and Matt Tebby. Aaron Sturkey edits and mixes the podcast. You can check out his mixing, engineering, and production work at aaronsturkey.com. We'd love to hear from you. To record a question or a comment for us, go to gravitycommons.com/message and click Start Recording button. You can also email us at podcast@gravitycommons.com. Catch you next time.
Over the last 75 years, over 10,000 chemicals have been introduced to our food supply. Yet the EU only allows 300 food additives. But at Thrive Market, we bring our members the highest quality brands and restrict more than 1,000 ingredients found at conventional grocery stores. Making the switch is easy with our Healthy Swaps scanner, which finds better versions of all your favorite pantry, snacking, and home essentials without the added junk, dyes, and fillers. Plus, it's all delivered straight to your door. So if you're looking to shop at a grocery store that actually cares about your health, go to thrivemarket.com/podcast and you'll get 30% off your first order and a free gift. Over the last 75 years, over 10,000 chemicals have been introduced to our food supply.
Yet the EU only allows 300 food additives. But at Thrive Market, we bring our members the highest quality brands and restrict more than 1,000 ingredients found at conventional grocery stores. Making the switch is easy with our Healthy Swaps scanner, which finds better versions of all your favorite pantry, snacking, and home essentials without the added junk, dyes, and fillers. Plus, it's all delivered straight to your door. So if you're looking to shop at a grocery store that actually cares about your health, go to thrivemarket.com/podcast and you'll get 30% off your first order and a free gift.